Minorities in Focus is made possible through a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Foundation in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Humanities. This program is the second of three, which focuses on the Black experience in Minnesota, past and present, with projected visions and hopes for the future. Part one of Blacks in Minnesota offered just a portion of that experience from the past. It talked about the first Blacks who settled in Minnesota. It touched upon their dreams and their struggles endured and their attempts to bring reality to those dreams. Part one of Blacks in Minnesota told what it was like for the average Black family in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. The older citizens of the Black community remember these days, and they attribute the survival of the Black community to the strength of its people and their will and ability to work together in overcoming all hardships. What has happened within the Black community in recent years? How much has been gained in the wake of the Black militant movement, the race riots in the Black ghettos throughout the nation, and social programs initiated by Democratic administrations? We went into the Black community and asked the residents what gains had been made. We interviewed many on a random basis, in such places as supermarkets and on the street. Questions pertain to such topics as education, employment, housing, politics, community pride, and unity. Minorities in Focus presents part two of Blacks in Minnesota, the present.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, father, we don't need to escalate.
Development of its children is an important facet of any community. What and how a child is taught in its developing years is vital to his or her self-image. It has an indelible effect on what that child will accomplish throughout life. The quality of that education determines the employment status of the child turned adult. Indeed, even the lifestyle he or she will be capable of achieving. Residents of the Black community felt that some strides had been made in recent years to improve the delivery of education for Black children. But when asked if the present public school system meets the needs of Black children, if it adequately prepares them for survival in this society, the overwhelming answer was no.
I want to know what's going on, baby. Yes, I want to know, yeah, what's going on right now, people.
We found that the few who said yes to this question were largely recent migrants from other states. They had limited experience with Minnesota's public school system and or were comparing it with the school system they had left. Cambone Kamara taught for a time at the Urban League Street Academy in Minneapolis, which is an educational alternative to the public schools. He is presently the executive director of the Minneapolis Urban League Emergency School Aid Act program. Mall ESA is a nonprofit community-based organization designed to aid in the desegregation of the Minneapolis public schools. We asked Mr. Kamara if he felt the public schools were meeting the needs of black children.
One of the things that I've observed, and I've talked with many other people who are very much aware of how black kids come to school to learn, sometimes for the first time, what it means to fail. It's like it's a natural state for a child to be curious, for a child to be eager to learn, for them to be excited about new kinds of experiences and information. That's just natural. And I think we see that throughout our community. It's no exception in that regard. But as soon as he begins to attend school, he begins to find this experience so frustrating because of, in many cases, the ignorance or the insensitivity of the teachers, the irrelevancy of the material that they use to try and convey certain skills or to develop certain skills with them. The whole thing gets to be such a frustrating experience until he turns off from the experience. And suddenly he is being categorized and viewed as a child who has a limited ability to learn. His attention span is short, they say. He is hyperactive. He won't sit down. Of course he's not going to sit down because he's bored, because nothing is being put before him that he finds challenging and interesting in a way that he can reasonably work with it. So he becomes a behavior problem, and once the child becomes a behavior problem, that means that he is a real problem then. And they start looking for other places to send him. And I think that, you know, that's one of the tragedies, because behavior becomes the prime concern rather than academic growth. I guess it's possible for a child to sit in school for 12 years if he doesn't disturb anyone without being considered a serious problem. And I think that that's tragic.
Mr. Kamara sees a direct relationship between lack of proper education and crime in the black community.
Another possibility, if the child gets caught up in acting out the role or image that he has of himself based on the kinds of things that have happened to him, he may pursue petty criminal kinds of activity, and then at that point he starts graduating from another, you know, series of institutions like Glen Lake and like Lionel Lakes and Red Wing and St. Cloud and ultimately Stillwater. So I think that those are two real possibilities, and I think that the third negative possibility is that they simply just drop out and just hang around, and of course that's nothing but trouble.
Published scholastic achievement scores show that on the average, black children score lower than their white counterpart. Mr. Kamara comments.
Statistics that have been gathered are generally limited to comparative studies in areas of high minority or black concentration with communities that are essentially all white. And I think that on the basis of those comparisons, we can say that those communities that have high concentrations of blacks and other minorities tend to be lower in achievement. And I guess we deduce from that that blacks certainly are not achieving at the same rate. I think that there are several reasons why we have to. One, I think, is the wide disparity between where the deliverers of the facilitator and classroom teacher is looking in terms of the child's response and where the cultural and environmental factors have actually prepared the child to function and respond. I think that it is not an exaggeration to say that the average classroom teacher in Minneapolis is white and middle class. And I think that that gives them a certain view of reality that differs tremendously from the reality that a child, say, coming from the Harrison-Glenwood area in South Minneapolis, in a community that would not qualify as a middle-class community, for example. The experiences that the child has had, the kind of family background, the kind of values that exist there, all of those things, I think, give a particular view of what is real in the world. And I think that certain patterns of expression, speech, language, that sort of thing, I think are also characteristics, maybe we could say, that some people use to try and make certain assumptions about what one's intellectual capacity is. And I think that this gulf or this discrepancy causes, first of all, an incorrect assessment in terms of where the child is actually capable of functioning. So I think that this, you know, causes the first problem. I think it continues to be a problem because many educators tend to have low expectations of black children, primarily because they feel that they have a slight handicap, a slight problem. Of course, the problem is that they're black. And of course, in the mind of the racist white teacher, that automatically limits the extent to which they feel that the child is actually capable of achieving. And I think that we all know that low expectations generally are met by low achievement. So it's kind of like what you expect is what you get kind of thing. That when you look at tests, you have to look at the cultural bias that are part of the test. And I think that it stands to reason that if I were to give you a test right now in terms of being able to locate where certain items are located in my home, and I sat down and took the same test, obviously I would probably get A, you know, 100% correct. And you may not get any correct. And based on that, I might conclude that I'm more intelligent than you are. And the fact is, you have not been exposed to my home. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing when we talk about culture bias. I think that in many cases, the kinds of things that they measure reflect more the white middle class exposure than it does what the real innate capacity to learn is. And I think that that's the fallacy.
In spite of these handicaps, there has been a distinct increase of black high school graduates in recent years, and the number of blacks reaching higher educational goals is rising.
In this whole world, you know, there are millions of boys and girls who are young, gifted, and black, with a soul intact, and that's a fact.
Government statistics show that unemployment for blacks is significantly higher than for whites. Although the gap is not as wide as in previous years, the average yearly income for the black family is still considerably less than that of the white family. Black youth are particularly hard hit. Statistics show them to be at the bottom of the employment ladder. Laura Scott is the director of the Minneapolis Urban League on-the-job training program. She describes that program's efforts in addressing the unemployment problem.
The purpose of the program is to provide entry-level opportunities for minorities and other disadvantaged individuals into the work world. We go out, contact employers, and we provide a reimbursement to the employers if they will hire someone who will come to them with a little less skills and perhaps someone they would just hire off the street. We can reimburse the employer up to 50% of the person's salary while that person is being trained to become a productive employee of the company.
We asked if OJT would be considered a career development program.
It is a career development program in the sense that we are a part of the Comprehensive Employment and Training Program for the City of Minneapolis. They have three tiers to the program. They have the centralized intake system where people come into the program. They're assessed as to where they are, where they want to go. They're assessed to their abilities. And if possible, they are slotted in a training program, which is our second tier. They are trained in either clerical, auto mechanics, machinists, and a number of other things. Drafting is included in that. The TCOICs of America is part of the program. The Occupational Skills Center is another part of the program. And as a smaller part of the program is the Minneapolis Urban League On-the-Job Training Program. Our purpose is to go out and get the person a job right away, and he gets training on the job. And that's the difference between what we have to offer and what they offer at the Skills Training Center. Theirs is a classroom type structure. Ours is you're doing it with your hands and you're learning while you're doing, and you're actually getting paid. Funded from the City of Minneapolis, they get their money through Title I of the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. This is an act that it's the special revenue sharing component for manpower programs. It's where they used to have the old manpower programs under categories, and now they have what they call a comprehensive system. They feel that if you have a comprehensive system, you're able to take one system, centralized system, and provide all the necessary services for that client, which would be basic education, skills training, or whatever that client would need. We enter into a contractual agreement with the employer. At the time the contract is signed, we negotiate so many training hours for the client with the understanding from the employer that once this person finishes the training, he will be retained in what we call unsubsidized employment.
John Prenier is the director of the Labor Education Advancement Program, which is an affiliate of the Minneapolis Urban League. We talked with Mr. Prenier regarding the purpose and goals of the program.
The LEAP program came to the Minneapolis area in 1969. It's here in cooperation with the Minneapolis Building Trades Council and the Minneapolis Urban League. Since that time, we have had a great amount of success, and we hope to continue this type of program for years to come. Originally, the LEAP program dealt only with building and construction trades apprenticeship. Since that time, we have broadened the program to include all phases of work, simply because we realized that our clients were not always interested in building and construction trades type work. So in order to address our services to their needs, we broadened the program to this effect.
Facets of the LEAP program include recruitment, interviewing, counseling, job development and referral, and follow-up retention services.
These are total program areas designed primarily to find meaningful employment for minorities and also to retain them on those jobs once they're placed. We currently receive money from two sources. One is the Department of Labor through our National Urban League offices, and the other source is the Community Development Block Grant monies.
Residents of the black community, when questioned, said that although gains have been made, there is still much to be done in the area of employment for blacks. On the subject of racial pride, those interviewed felt that there is a pronounced increase of pride in the black heritage. They felt that the black so-called militant movement of the 60s had an effect on how blacks view themselves, and they see more of a sense of unity developing within the black community. Ann Darby, a community organizer for the Minneapolis Urban League, says her job allows her to see both the problems and successes of the black community.
I guess we have an opportunity to see the black community from both sides, not only from problems, but from successes as well. I think as I look at my children and as I look at the children of my friends and those persons that I've been close to, I see some of the young blacks, especially in the ages of 13 to 14, really having a lot of self-confidence, being not afraid to accept challenges, being not afraid to strive for excellency, being not afraid to stand on their own beliefs. And I believe that I would term that as a success.
Rhonda is a young black woman who is presently enrolled at the Street Academy in South Minneapolis. She reflects an attitude growing within many young blacks today.
For myself, hey, I have dreams, you know, because there's no need of me running my life history story down to you. But at one time, I felt lonely and said to myself, hey, I'm never going to go back to school because I can't stand sitting up in a school no 8 hours a day, you know. But I got to thinking, I've seen examples, I've looked at experience, other experiences, and say, well, that's not where I want to be, you know. I'm black, I want to stand up for the black people to help educate other blacks, older or younger, and they can educate me just as well, you know. And I want to be somebody. I'm 17 years old. I've made my mind, and I'm determined to do what I said I'm going to do, and that is one day I will be somebody. And up until the day I die, I'm going to stick to that word.
This has been part two of Blacks in Minnesota. You've heard how many blacks view such areas as education, employment, and pride in relation to themselves and their present-day community. In part three, we will focus on hopes and visions of blacks in Minnesota, the future. I'm Jeanette Cotton.
I feel that the school system, the public school system, is teaching more to the needs of the white race because they don't teach you too much about what happened to your ancestors. They're teaching you about Scandinavia and them coming over and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of times blacks get stuck on that because, you know, you really can't relate to that because you don't, you know, really know what was going down back then. You know, your mom and dad hadn't really been telling you about, well, yeah, you know, the pilgrims came over and what they were into and all that. So all you really have been exposed to is what the blacks are doing. And at the public schools, they're teaching, you know, mostly about what the white people had done. And the white kids, you know about it. So they're getting a lot higher grades. And plus, if you're in a school that's predominantly white, you know, a lot of times you get the rough edge. You know, they'll put a lot of things down on you. You know, that I've even gone through myself. You really don't have any kind of support. In a public school, you're just a number.
can't see anywhere that it's going to get better unless, you know, they get more black people involved into the teaching area.
I would like to see a black person walk up to somebody's favorite, somebody's big business office, fill out an application, and hey, they got a job just as easy as a white man would, you know? Because a white man can do that, and so can the white woman, you know? But blacks, it's a lot harder for blacks because of the color of their skin.
People want to get organized. If you talk about black people and you say we, you know, as black people, this, that, and the other, instead of they as black people, you know, because we is a word that means unity itself. You know, when you hear that word we, you know, it don't mean nothing in your mind but strength. When you hear someone say we, they talking about more than one.
I don't care nothing about a white dude, you know, but I learned that we got to, you know, communicate with them and deal with them simply because they are a being, you know, and we have to, you know, just deal with them because they are here.
Everybody don't want no dope in no communities. Everybody wants to be able to walk the streets freely, you know. Don't nobody like carrying a pistol because it's heavy. It's heavy.
You know, I think that the blacks are really starting to get into the government scene now. You know, everything is starting to shape up more, and they're starting to get into the neighborhood, you know. Maybe they can get some unity together for the neighborhood and get the black people on the move. Maybe if we can get some good black leaders in there that aren't out there for the beat, you know, we should be able to maybe get some unity together.
The opinions expressed here are entirely those of the participants of the program and do not reflect those of the Minnesota Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.